Hey, I think it's time to listen to that station, planet, the prison planet, you know, Earth, with BBS radio. Let me adjust the frequency so we can listen to it.
Well, everyone, first of all, I want to thank BBS radio for having me and hosting my show. When pigs fly, when there is no BS, we just tell it straight how it is. And like I said, my name is Andrew Fetter. And again, I want to thank all those who are listening now and into the future on Future Archives. So I just want to get into some elements of what today's subject line is, which I'm going to discuss today, which is about the Middle East. And I'm looking at from both as a pragmatic and a spiritual base. And that includes the spirituality as well as the historical points within the Middle East. And before I do, I want to recap a couple things I had said in my last two shows. And basically, when I spoke of there's walking toward the light, the path of light, and walking toward the path of dark. Obviously, when you're walking toward the path of dark, you would utilize hate, intolerance, emanating violence, incitement to hate, the thought of walking toward the darkness, including using guilt. But if you're walking toward the light, in the path of light, using love, tolerance, compassion, and charity. So just want to reiterate that when I talk to about the subjects we're going to talk about. And then, of course, everybody thinks of the Middle East. They think of, well, today, a lot of people are looking at the Iraq situation with the war and what that encompasses and what's going on, as well as, obviously, when the first thing you say Middle East, the first thing everybody pops in their mind is the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian-Israeli dilemma, and so on. So I think it's really important to understand history, because too much is simply, if people do not understand and recognize the history, they become ignorant of what the situation is. And so what happens when people don't know history, they end up repeating history or cause drastic mistakes. For example, like Bush in Iraq, not understanding or his colleagues understanding the true nature of the Middle East or its history or its foundation and what they had created, or if that was their true intention. Sometimes I'm wondering if that was their real intention of the Iraq war and just playing the magic trick so get some oil and Halliburton doing its boost of major profit. But in doing so, a lot of people, again, do not make statements about Israel, about the Palestinians, without any real knowledge of the background and the history, or even understanding what Jews are, what the name of a Jew is, and what is a Palestinian, how that came about, what is Palestine, and how that came about. Because it's important to understand where the true nationalism occurred and what the situation occurred. So let's start from way back. First of all, I want to reiterate, Israel is a Jewish state. And Jewish, I don't mean by just a religion alone, it's by ethnic. So if someone out in the street goes, hey there, Andrew, what is a Jew? I thought a Jew is a religion, like Christian, like Muslim, like Hindu. Well, yes and no. Jew pertains to somebody believing in Judaism, but not necessarily. In fact, it really isn't. It's talking of your origin. There's agnostic Jews, atheist Jews, and simply speaking, Jew means from Judea. And I'll explain how all this came about. If you go back to the origins from everybody knows the starting of the Bible, if you look back and, you know, who built, how, you know, Israel became a state, you know, full functional back in the Bible, where there's King Saul and he was fighting off the Philistines, and eventually King David became the king, and then he finally got rid of the Philistines within proper Israel, or Israel in the biblical sense. Not just biblical sense, but that was thus Israel then, and that's what they call it. And he got rid of the Philistines. And he then built Jerusalem. And by the way, Jerusalem is Hebrew. It's Jewish. It's Jewish as saying Cheyenne is Native American. Lakota is Dakota. Mojave is Native American. Just like Hebron is Jewish, it's Hebrew. So the very essence of what he ended up building was Jerusalem. And then when he had a son, King Solomon, and he built the temple and expanded Jerusalem, and Israel grew, which was sort of amazing because under King Solomon's rule, Israel grew, and you can call it the mini empire or whatever, but it was without a war. It was basically through diplomacy. In fact, an interesting thing, and you can check it, but through the Western world, I'm not sure of the Eastern world, but I know for a fact in the Western world, there during the reign of King Solomon, it is the only time there was peace throughout the world, which is sort of interesting. So, not to say, but it just sort of strange. That's sort of very interesting in a biblical sense or even a spiritual sense. Maybe he was the wise king. So, down the line, obviously, you look in the Bible, and in your history, biblical history, and your theological history, you see Israel, you know, the kings, the sons of King Solomon, and so on and so on. Eventually, there were two brothers who couldn't share control of Israel, so they ended up splitting Israel into two. Now, what's Judea, by the way? Judea, actually, the term comes from Judah, because the tribe of Judah controlled where Jerusalem is, and most of the today would be, including the West Bank, would be the top two-thirds of Israel. That was part of Judea, and the rest of the 10 tribes were up in the north, you know, like Ephraim and all the rest of them. Anyway, so, except for exclusive of Dan, which was down near Gaza. So, which ended up moving up north because of the Philistines, the Dan tribe ended up moving up toward the Galil as well. So, because basically in Israel, when it was originally it was set up in almost like a tribal state, each tribe had its own little state system, almost like the United States. So what happened was, like I get back, Israel then got split up between two kingdoms. It was the lower half, like I said, was Judea. The northern half was called Israel. And then, subsequently, obviously, when you read about this, is about the Syrians and how they came up. And the Syrians originally from Syria, from the modern-day Syria area, and attacked and took control and wiped out and beat, you know, Israel, the northern state, because they're, like I said, there are two states that had separated. And when they did that, they removed all inhabitants. It just like disappeared. Boom. Which is what they talk about, the 10 lost tribes. There are no 10 lost tribes. All those tribes are gone. Nobody knows where they are. Who knows where they are? So what tribe was left? Judah. The Levites, which controlled the temple. And there are the Kohens, who were the priests. So everybody was basically part of the Judah or Judea tribe or Judea. And then what happened was, even though the Judeans had, or at the time had fought back, or the Jews, Judeans had fought back the Syrians and kept them at bay, long behold came the Babylonians, who then kicked the butt out on the Syrians, and then finally attacked Judah, or Judea. And this is where we heard the first time referring to Jews from Judea by the Babylonians. That's what they called them. Because up until they were calling, you know, from Judeans rather than Jews, they started calling them Jews. And of course, we know the history. They destroyed the temple. And the first thing they did to make sure that there wouldn't be any uprising or control, they take the leadership, which is basically within the Jerusalem area, and move large segments of the population. They basically, hand and foot, took them back to Israel. Or, I mean, excuse me, back to Babylon. They removed them from Judea. Now, this is when the time period, and you can check out when the prophets, at this time, during this period, we first heard the words, the Zionist movement, or Tzioni. And by the way, Zion means is Har Tzion. Zion is Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is built on the mountain called Zion, or Tzion in Hebrew, the correct way of saying it. So, this is where the fundamentals of what Zionism, because functionally Zionism is Judaism, is functionally the return of the land, contrary to people referring it as being racist or something, whatever. It'd be almost like saying the Shoshones taking back their land, the Arapaho taking back Colorado, the Iroquois taking back the eastern United States. They are the indigenous, the very, you know, that they are of native of America. So it would be sort of the same token. So this movement started off at that time. In fact, there's the famous quote out of one of the prophets had said, as they were being handcuffed and brought back, or handcuffed, strapped, you know, like almost like slaves, back to Babylon, they had declared, if I ever forget, O Jerusalem, may I cut off my right hand. Meaning their right hand, their heart. So it became a pitch. We will return back to Zion, back to Jerusalem, which is constantly referred with all the several prophets following from that time forward. In fact, during the time of Babylon is when the first Talmud was started being written, the Oral Law, which I discussed earlier, like I question how they made certain things. But talking from a nationalistic point, because this was a nationalism, it is also referred into like Zionism, or a return back to Jerusalem, with a very core within Judaism amongst Jews. Because basically when you're saying Zionist, Zionist is Jew. And I don't care how politically correct some people want to say it, but it's just another way of, instead of trying to not say being sound anti-Semitic, they will say Zionist, because it's one and the same. And no matter how way you get around it, it is a Jew, you know. And now you can say, I believe I'm a Jew who's a Zionist, and you say you're anti-Zionist, meaning you're just anti being nationalistic toward, what is it, being nationalist Jews. It would be like Mexican saying, I'm not really pro-Mexican, about Mexicans going back to living in Mexico, or you know, their identity toward Mexico, or the French toward France, or English toward England, or like the Lakota of the Dakotas. So what I'm gathering at is the names and nomenclature, things miscellaneously, wrongly used, and for purpose or reasons, I'm trying to establish on what these things are real, history is real. So anyway, getting back, the Jews living now in Babylon, you know, during that time, there was also like the Seder book that people read about. In fact, Passover is coming up. At the very end of Passover, what is said next year in Jerusalem. So, like I said, it is a very core within Judaism of returning to Zion, returning to Israel, Zion, to Jerusalem, henceforth. You know, and like I said, Jew to Israel is just as much as like Lakota, Cheyenne, Iroquois, Navajo to the same of what is America. They are the very indigenous people of that area, the Holy Land, Israel, Judea, Samaria. So, you know, that's why there you hear a lot of religious extremists say, hey, this is our land. It is, they are a part of that. But it being pragmatic, people, which I'll get into, you have situations that occur with two populations moving into the same area and people from the outside instigating things, inciting things amongst, you know, amongst these people, amongst the Jews and the Arabs for their own gain, which I'll get into. But I'm like, I reiterate, Zionism is Judaism. Being an anti-Zionist is anti-Jew and anti-Semite. There's no ifs or buts. That's pure and simple. You can play it around. It's almost like, I remember you talked to black friends of mine who would say, you know, you don't, if a white person would not understand when a white person uses the N-word in a slur or see somebody who is being racist, they would not pick up on it. Just like a Jew would pick up normally anti-Semitic behavior, hatred toward them. It's sort of hard because you're not in their shoes, but you see it. And notwithstanding, I forgot to give you my background. First of all, and you probably see it that on my website, which is at www.andrewfetter.com, or you can see, I think they have it also up my bio. I lived in Israel from 77 to 78 as an exchange student. And then I moved there in 1980, and lived there from 1980 to 86. And I had a farm and whatnot. And my best friend, like my brother, was an Arab. An Israeli Arab, a Palestinian, whatever you want to call it, but he lived in Kfar Qara. And during the 80s, I had a lot of friends who I used to go drink coffee and stuff and hang out with them over in Tukaram as well, beside Enkel, which is in the West Bank or the Palestinian territories. So I have a very in-depth knowledge and experiences knowing the mentality and the framework of the minds of the Palestinians and the Arabs and the Jews and the Israelis in that area. Contrary to, you know, the Noam Chomsky's or Dershowitz or any of the other people who talk of from out their Aryans about the Middle East, which they have no idea, you know, of concern. What they're talking, they pull out little passages from left and right, left and right, left and right. It's not really real unless you look at the overall history, which now I'm starting getting off tangent, but I just want you that perspective from where I live, and not saying because I'm Jewish, oh, this is his perspective because he's a Jew. I'm just telling you how it is, and then I'll get to my framework of why, with how to fix the situation. So anyway, as I explained, the Babylonians and the Israeli, the Jews, and how they end up going to eventually Cyrus the Great in Persia, beat up Babylonia, decided to allow the Jews back to Israel and build their temple back in Jerusalem. And then it was called forever, that was called returning to Zion, returning to Zion, returning to Jerusalem. And of course, we all know the history where the Alexander Greeks beat Persia. 100 years later, and then when Alexander died, then later on, you know, got his empire got split up, where Antony took control of that was Judea, and then those rulers of Antonic area, which is the Greeks of that time, control of Israel, where they were changed from Alexander's rule of tolerance to one of dictatorship and forcing Jews to not believe their freedom, you know, they believe in their Judaic ways. So there was rebellion, and everybody knows the story of, I don't know if they know the story of Hanukkah, but that's basically religious freedom with the Maccabees and the Maccabeans ultimately kicking out and beating the Greeks, the great Greeks, and that's the story of Hanukkah. And then from that time, that country was called Judea. Because it was called Judea amongst the Greeks, it was called Judea amongst the Babylonians. Like I said, it was called Judea, and the people living there were called Jews. Even the Romans called it Judea. So, Jew means from Judea, someone who believes necessarily in Judaism. And like I said, there are atheists, agnostics, Jews, Einstein, wasn't exactly religious. Freud was not exactly religious. He was a Jew. Spinoza was a Jew. Even Karl Marx was a Jew, and he was an atheist. And even Noam Chomsky, he's a Jew. He doesn't practice it, but he's a Jew. So Jew means is your ethnicity, just like from, you know, where you're, if you left Russia, my great-great-grandparents who left Russia in Latvia, they weren't called Russians, they were called Jews when they came here. My father's father came from Poland. They didn't call him Polish. They called him a Polish Jew, designating that he was Jewish. Of course, Hitler proved that because he said even people who were hiding, you know, who had simulated becoming Christians religiously, he said, oh, you're still a Jew. So that took, that Emily, that situation, what is a Jew? And like I get back to the history, then the Jews, the Jewish revolt, which almost fought off the Romans, and there was a famous battle, which is talked about by Josephus Flavius in his book called The Jewish Wars, who was a historian of that time, and spoke out of the major battle in Galilee, which finally the Romans broke through, and eventually they won, you know, and they kept on their way toward Jerusalem, destroying the temple and slaughtering Jews left and right. And they want to make a symbol of Israel, of what this an example of what not to do, a revolt, especially the revolt that almost broke their back. What they did was they removed the, besides slaughtering the Jews, a lot of Jews ran out, left Israel or Judea. And they decided to call it, change the name to add insult to injury. They call it Palestina, or Palestine, which is Latin for Philistine. It's like sticking in your face. Ha ha ha. We're now calling you the Philistines. It would be almost like calling, well, not to that much, but calling a black person by the N-word. It's just sort of rubbing it into their face. They would do everything to just shove it because they are so full of anger of how, you know, here's his people who bought them off.
I'm just breaking in here. I apologize. Are you there, still there?
Yeah, I hear you.
Now, we are on an analog line, but we are getting almost like digital noises.
Okay.
And I don't know why you'd be getting digital noise. Have you been hearing them?
I hear a little bit, but it hasn't bothered me.
Okay. Well, we'll just keep going, but we are on analog lines. So.
Okay.
Okay.
So like I said, but during this time, Jews still maintain their presence within Judea and within Israel. And even when the Crusaders took control of Jerusalem, they talk about slaughtering Jews and Muslims alike in Jerusalem. There was always a presence of Jews. And when Saladin reconquered Jerusalem from the Crusaders, he never did refer to land as Palestine. In fact, he referred to it as Holy Land. In fact, just like the Crusaders, from the time of the fall of the Romans, it was referred to as the Holy Land. Now, subsequently, too, there was still movement of some Jews moving back into Israel. And one of the main, because of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, a major movement of Jews had started moving back in there, and such as Mohammedes and a lot of Kabbalists, actually, Yochanan ben Zakkai, Da'ari, and so on. And they also formed a huge community along Eretz Tzfat, which is a city just north of the Galilee, and it became a very center spot for these Hasids, these very religious Kabbalists. And there was about, they said, approximately 15,000 to 30,000, and some people say even more, living of very religious Jews around the Kinneret at that time. And this is all the way through the 1600s to the early 1700s. So there was always a Jewish presence, and even in Jerusalem. So from the time of the fall of Rome until the 1900s, Judea, Israel, or what some Palestinians or Arabs call Palestine, it's never referred to Palestine. It wasn't referred to Judea now. It was never referred to as Israel, but the Holy Land. And then there was Mark Twain, who, when he visited, he also referred it to as the Holy Land. But there's something interesting that when Mark Twain had visited the Holy Land and went on his way to Jerusalem, he said there weren't that many people there. There are hardly any Arabs, and there are many Jews, but the country is basically desolate. In fact, I'll take a quote from his book, which is from Innocents Abroad, and you can check it out. And this is during his trip in 1867, and I believe his book was published in 1869 about the population within Israel, the Holy Land, Palestine, whatever name you want to call it right now. But he said, a desolate country, this is a description of a desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given over wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse, a desolation. We never saw a human being on the whole trip, hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere, even the olive tree and cactus, those fast friends of worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. That was from page 361 to 362, if you ever want to check that out. There was also a communique from the British consulate in 1857 in Jerusalem, reported that the country is considerably degree empty of inhabitants, and therefore its greatest need is that of a body of population. 1857, there was nobody there by British consulate. And the same thing was said by Mark Twain. I don't think any of them were Jewish or made up stuff, or they weren't like Zionists or something, like, you know, some would say. In fact, there's a continuation of James Finn, who was Earl of Carnarvon in 1857 September, according to his belief that about 25% of the Muslims who lived in all of Palestine in 1882 were newcomers. And the reason why I put that in parentheses, Palestine, because he didn't refer to it as Palestine, were newcomers of descendants of those who arrived. In fact, they were just like from Egypt. They all came, they were all new. And he was referring to because Egypt had temporarily conquered and then lost, of course, to the Ottomans in 1831. So basically, it was basically empty. And then all of a sudden, in 1870 through the 1880s, the modern Jewish Zionist or the modern Zionist movement came from Europe. And by the way, there was always a continuation of Jews from the Arab countries coming into Israel. And as they immigrated into Israel, so did Arabs, because it was like, you know, they planted a farm or something, and then it developed an economy. They started one village, a Jewish tribe would. A Jewish village would start, and then an Arab village would move in, and, you know, it was natural economics. Two peoples moving together, for one out of nationalism and trying to start something new, and then another one out of, you know, migrating for to betterment their families. Just as like, you know, Mexicans wanting to come into America to better themselves, and nothing wrong with that. And they became cohesive. They actually lived in peace all through this time. There have been minor skirmishes, minor things, but basically, it was relatively not so bad. Now, when did all this change? It all started in World War One, when, and by the way, the dialects in Hebrew, if you listen to how they speak, and this is just, I know for sure, is they, in the West Bank, they speak Assyrian dialect, and if you go into the Gaza area, they speak with an Egyptian dialect. And by the way, Israel is very, very teeny. So having such a difference in dialect is major difference. That'd be like in L.A., it's in L.A. County, Los Angeles County, having two different dialects within the same county. Now, come on. So anyway, and by the way, even like I said, I knew from talking with my friends who are my Arab friends, they even told me, you know, when I asked, you know, where's your grandfather? Oh, he was born on the way over to Israel. And then I asked them, well, where were they for that? And they'll even admit that they were like from Syria or modern Iraq. Most of them were actually from Syrian Damascus area. So anyway, after World War One, the Ottomans, who had control, took the wrong side, obviously, and lost. And so the British, under the League of Nations, have a promise under the League of Nations to allow the Jews to form their own country and help them in doing so, was given the Palestine Mandate. And this is called the Balfour Declaration, which they acknowledged they would do whatever they could to help the Jews form their country. So But what happened? What messed up? Well, Lawrence of Arabia, you heard about him and seen him in the movie. Well, he had sort of a relationship with a sheikh called Sheikh Abdullah, which then became king of Transjordania. Now, who was King Abdullah, or Sheikh Abdullah? He was from Saudi Arabia. And by the way, there were no countries, no Arab countries except for Egypt at that time. There was no Jordan, no Saudi Arabia, no Qatar, no even Syria at that time. By the way, the Syrian mandate was under the French, which then carved out Lebanon as an enclave for Christians. And that's, which I'll get into, but they started doing these partitions based upon ethnicity, sort of like what India, when India was then partitioned to create Pakistan. There was then, first there was East and West Pakistan, and of course, I believe East Pakistan became then Bangladesh after the wars they had with India, and now they just call Pakistan East or West Pakistan, just Pakistan. And that was a part of the partition. And Jordan was part of Palestine. That's why a lot of you heard Israeli Jews and say, hey, that's a Palestine. So they'll have a second Palestinian state. They have Palestine and then Jordan. Well, Jordan really is a Palestinian state. 90%, that's why 90% of the population is Palestinian. And the rulers are Bedouins, from which is King Abdullah now, whose grandfather King Abdullah and his father King Hussein was part of, or actually Hashemites, or Hashemites are Bedouins from modern Saudi Arabia. So basically, and it's sort of the same thing when Iraq was created. What was Iraq? That was created by under their that mandate. That was actually created just so for the British to have control of the oil. And that was basically a triangle they created with the Kurds and Shiites and the Sunnis, much like they did with Jordan. And then they took a Hashemite king, just like they did from with King Abdullah. They put King Faisal, who was a Hashemite sheikh from Arabia, and made him king of Iraq. And that's why you have Iraq. And like I said, then there, of course, Lebanon was partitioned. And so what was the concern? It was basically British oil. It was over the oil thing. This whole now scenario you'll start seeing come about. You know, the game. The British had control. And you got to realize, this is back then, the Britain was an empire. You know, they had their colonies from Burma and Asia, and they still had India, and they had control of even Egypt, which was supposed to be an independent country, but never was. So they had their control and everything, and it was over goods. It was over oil. So their oil thing was they had the oil that was found in Turkirk, which is near in the Kurdish area. And they had those lines, they developed shipping lines through railway system that you can still see today, going from Iraq through Syria to Haifa. Now what's in Haifa, which is an area that was built up by a mass movement of German Jews back in the early 1900s and 1920s, and they built the refineries later on. And so they would ship their oil straight to Haifa, refine it, and then ship it. Had a nice thing going. So they played the game, and then they realized, the British started realizing, well, wait a second, the Jews actually are going to have they're getting too organized, because they never really thought that they would organize to such a degree of being independent. So out of politics and playing the game, and playing the best thing to do is divide and conquer, as they say, they started inciting the Arabs to hate the Jews. And this started early 1920s. And then they try to restrict the movement of Jews immigrating into Israel by creating what they call is known as the White Paper. And this White Paper was carried all the way through the time limiting the Jews, and of course Jews were trying to be smuggled out from Europe, even during from not Europe. But this hatred that continued was the very core that started everything toward the Jews. And the hatred led to massive murders, massacres. I mean, devastating massacres in the 1920s. And in fact, in the 30s, there was literally a genocide of Jews in Hebron. In fact, Hebron was 90% Jewish. You can even go in there and I can show you, can see in where even where Arabs live today, Palestinians live today, you can see where the mezuzahs were inside the door frame, because they used to cut it in a stone and stick them inside the door frames. So what happened after that? The Jews started, you know, countering. In fact, by the way, Jews were not allowed to have their own guns. Arabs were. That was British law. I mean, basically, they're setting them up to be slaughtered. So there are groups that developed that became the revolters, the freedom fighters, whatever you want to call it. And then depending whose perspective and whose glasses you're wearing, some people would call them freedom fighters, others would call them terrorists, like their Gun and Stern group, which was actually part of the Haganah, which broke off and had their own view. And the reason why is because they felt they had to use military or violent ways to get the British out of Israel. Well, Haganah wanted to play the political game still. And the Haganah, which is Ben Gurion's backing, and Haganah was part of that more of a moderate, you can call it, and their Gun, which is headed by Menachem Begin, the Abraham Stern, the Stern group, wrote it violently. And of course, they say they were terrorists because Ergun blew up the King David Hotel. And when you think of King David Hotel, people first think of, like, it must be like, the Luxor, or, you know, the MGM here in Las Vegas. You know, but it isn't. The King David Hotel was the central intelligence headquarters for the British. So it was a military, strike. I mean, I know people who were being hung in Akko prison and they were freed, they had nooses around their neck, and their only crime was they had a gun. They were being hung because they had a gun, and they were being hung by the British. They had a gun to protect themselves. So then I go into the history leading into World War II. And a leader of now the Palestinians, at that time they started developing the nationalistic movement. That's when you start hearing the word Palestinian, by the way, was within the 1920s and 30s. And a leader named, who was the leader of the Palestinians, was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. And when he was extremely allied with Hitler. In fact, he met with Hitler in Berlin. And they cohorted on a scheme that, well, when Hitler finishes the Jews in Europe, when he moves down into Palestine or Israel, he'll wipe them out as well. And the Grand Mufti was part of that. He wanted to help in the final solution. In fact, this is a fact, and you can check it out. In fact, there's even pictures of it, even on the History Channel shows it, how the Grand Mufti had a group of Palestinians who became a part of the SS, who helped train along with the SS and became part of the final solution to the Jews. This may be why a lot of times they don't like to talk about the Holocaust within their own books, with them, especially amongst Palestinians, about their involvement with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and the Palestinian history and their ally and their political alliance with Hitler. So anyway, getting back to everything, the Brits finally conspired after they were forced and told to be, leave under the partition plan, to leave Israel by the UN. And of course, we all know the history of the Israelis beat them back. And in fact, the Brits had conspired because the Jordanian legions was trained and actually, the plan to attack Israel was how to do it was set up by the Brits. And then even in Jaffa, there was a British contingency there. And of course, there's a famous story about what happened there with how very few Jews had fought them off, and basically the Brits ran out and left Jaffa. So then what happened? All of a sudden they fought back, and the Palestinians didn't accept the partition plan, which would have given them a Palestinian state, besides there's the Palestinian state of Jordan. They didn't accept it. And then all the Palestinians were told to leave, by the way, right before the attack, because they were promised by the Arab countries, oh, we'll just give you that land back in Morsel, which is all BS. We knew what they were going to do. They were going to be out there. And if, God forbid, Israel wasn't there, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, and all of them would have just swallowed up Israel for their and partition, how they fought amongst themselves over it. But Israel won and established a state in 48. And then what happened to the Palestinians? Well, the Jordanians gave Arabs in the West Bank citizenship because they looked at West Bank as part of Jordan. It wasn't called being occupied, incidentally. So it was just interesting. And the rest of the Palestinians were sticking these little refugee separation areas on the Egyptians and whatnot, and Lebanese, and nobody really assimilated them except for Jordan. They did it because they were basically Palestinian anyway. Now we go, like, who were the players in this whole game? Well, the Soviets originally supported Israel until then. They were actually the ones who supplied and backed Israel because they were going against the British. The Americans put an embargo against the Jews in Israel in 1948. And then the players switched again in 1956 when Nasser, who took control of Egypt over the king after the assassination of the king in Egypt, and took control of Egypt and made it a very, I guess, lenient toward being Marxist or socialist, but it was more like totalitarian. And he nationalized the Suez Canal, which pissed off the French and the Brits, and then he tried sending his Fedayeen, which is the modern, which was then the historical start of the historical organization of terrorism. And who led that? Oh, Arafat, by the way. He was part of that, the Fedayeen, in the 1950s. In fact, he was Egyptian. He was not Palestinian. He was not born in, he was born in Egypt, raised in Egypt, went to Israel and lived in Jerusalem for a short period of time with his uncle who lived in Jerusalem, went back to Egypt, finished his studies, was an engineer, and then when Nasser took over, he became, in fact, he was in the Egyptian army, and then later on he started the Fedayeen under Nasser. So the switched teams. All of a sudden the Brits came in power, took control, and the French, you know, they switched sides and became on their side, and they supported Israel until 1967, and that's why Israelis were flying, you know, the Mirage. They didn't fly any American arms. They're using French and British arms. And then when the 67 happened and Israel kicked butt on the Arab countries who tried to start attacking them, sealed up the Straits of Tehran, threatening to invade. In fact, they had all their forces up to invade and wipe out Israel. That's when the U.S. came in the game. They realized they're a functioning power. And then the Soviets became totally involved, realizing, wait a second, Israel is being backed now by the U.S. Well, they just jumped on board with all the rest of the Arabs, like the Syrians. And they were tied in with the PLO. In fact, Arafat was basically financed and backed by the PLO. The Soviets backed the PLO. And of course, we know the 73 war and whatnot. And what happened with the Syrians and the Egyptians, and they attacked Israel again on their holiest day. And then this is when the change of players occurred. This is when Kissinger met with Sadat and took out the Soviet influence, thus starting a base for peace. I mean, Carter got the prize, but it was all Kissinger. And I'm talking pragmatically now, what happened. Oh, Jordan didn't get involved in the 73 war because they were in a de facto peace with Israel since 1970, since the September, called the Black September time for the PLO, because it was when they attacked King Hussein's army and tried to overthrow King Hussein, Israel backed Jordan and helped them remove the PLO out of Jordan. In fact, I remember living in Israel, even sending products and everything there. You can trade through Jordan. There's the famous Allenby Bridge, and there's several bridges that they were going back and forth to trade. So what happened in the 80s? How does it all start with what happened with the, you know, I mean, living there, I can tell you right now that the Arabs living in Palestinians are very wealthy, living very good. It's not contrary to a lot of people said. You know, they talk about apartheid and all that. No, 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 no. That was all BS. And when you close a door, by the way, even amongst Arabs or Palestinians in the West Bank, all they really care is, you know, to live good. In fact, they were hoping to be Israeli. They thought in the 1980s, after the Jordan withdrew its claim of the West Bank, that they would become Israeli citizens. Because Israel had just annexed, officially annexed the Golan Heights, and they thought they were next because there were talks of it. But then Israel realized, wait a second, we can't annex the West Bank because that'd be the population of Arabs would eventually overcome Israel and lose its Jewish identity. Not to say, of course, they'll say that's being racist, but they're just trying to keep it, their country is a Jewish state, which people have to realize. For thousands of years of persecution, they just wanted their little piece of the rock to live and have their own place. Which some people don't understand that, but that's the fact. So the Enfidia started because there was a void. Palestinians were now nothing. So, and this was in the late 80s, and so Rabin and Peres puts out their hand and reaches to Arafat, bring him back into the courts, which started with the Madrid and so on, and we all know about Oslo peace agreement. But instead of getting the chance of establishing a Palestinian state, Arafat just continued to rip off his own people. In fact, people keep on talking about the injustices to the Palestinians, the injustice of not creating their own state. The injustice of Arafat stealing billions of dollars to buy arms to continue the magic game so they would attack. And by the way, billions of dollars that came from the U.S. and European nations to build a Palestinian state, where was the money coming from? Arab countries. There was none. Not from Saudi Arabia or any of the others. Not even from Iran. Because look where the truth is. Who really wants peace between the Palestinians and Israelis? And that's where I'm getting to. There are two peoples who basically moved into that area. Different things caused, I don't want to get into it, like I just said, that was the historical truth. The spiritual truth is now you have a situation with two people, and this, we do have a dry bones, and you know, and if you read Ezekiel, it's almost like prophecy coming true. But for every action, there's a reaction. So who's got to take responsibility? I think the Palestinians themselves have to take responsibility. They didn't accept a peace agreement back in 2000, which would have gave them right now a state. They need to take responsibility for carrying out terrorist attacks. Excuse me, for every action, there's a reaction. I'm not saying the Israelis are any good. Believe me, I thought it was wrong for them continuing in the 1990s. Still building new settlements. I think that was totally wrong. And anybody who starts degrading Arabs or Palestinians as subhuman or anything malicious, I think that's wrong. Or anything hateful toward Arabs. They're your brothers. But the same thing has to be said about the Palestinians, which is not ever reiterated by the progressives. They have to stop the hate, drop the guns, no more Hamas, because all they are is a functional Nazism, and it's in a functional, misguided, not even true Islam, projecting hate. And by the way, talk about responsibility. When the Israelis withdrew from Gaza, first reaction was, hey, you know what? They withdrew. Let's move in forward for peace. Man, I thought after the withdrawal from Gaza, especially Ariel Sharon doing it, there'd be real peace finally. But instead, they voted for Hamas. And everybody can make excuses for corruption or whatever, but that they just voted in the Nazi party. Because they are like Nazis. They want to do a final solution to Jews in the Middle East. So, who's responsible? You got to take responsibility for every action and reaction. Now, I want to say something about the hate. And who would want to perpetuate the hate? Because, as like I said, walking through the dark. Who would gain if Israel and the Palestinians had peace? Well, I know one. Israel would sure as hell benefit. Having peace on its side for the first time. Because it's basically being in a war state, so therefore they've had basically had to be under martial law continuously for over, what now, 60, 70 years now. The Palestinians would definitely have their homeland, sense of identity now, out of the vacuum. But who would not benefit from a peace agreement? Think about it. I don't think Jordan would want a Palestinian state sitting right next to them that's democratic while they have a monarchy government, a minority of Bedouins controlling 90% of the Palestinians. I don't know if the Egyptians would like a Palestinian state that's democratic, almost a mirror image of Israel. I don't think the Syrians would like that either. In fact, I don't think the Saudis would like that either. Could you imagine a democratic, a society in Palestine, in a state that has tolerance, where people don't matter what they are, not necessarily perfect, not as even Israel's not perfect either. I mean, they have their things, so basically a socialized country, which limits people's freedom. You know, like people don't understand, but it's not America. It's not the United States of America. So, what I'm gathering at, think about the players. Who would benefit and who would not benefit? Because that tells you why there's not peace in Israel and not why there's not peace in Palestine and why there's still the continuing bickering. But I have hope. I think that something's going to happen. And I hate to say it, there's not going to be a Palestinian state. They did to themselves. They had a chance and great opportunities. They kept on missing one after another. And now they have this unity government of appeasement from a civil war. It's basically putting a band-aid over a war. But I think, in reality, a boss knows, and there's a game going on, that eventually that's going to be broken. Because basically Oslo is dead. Oslo died when Arafat did not enter that compromise agreement. And like I use the word compromise, because both sides have to compromise. And there was a great agreement that would have had a state. It would have been 7 years now, a Palestinian state right now. They still have a chance. I still don't think it's going to happen. Because of choices have been made. And every choice creates a new path. And if you choose hatred and choose darkness, there's a reaction to that. And I am more of a optimist in that area. But I think it's going to go back to what's called the Alone Plan. And what was the Alone Plan? This is when I think Israel sort of messed up personally. You know, like a big mistake with Jordan. I think the first thing they should have done is when we realized not annexing they weren't going to annex the West Bank, instead of reaching out to Arafat, she reached out to King Hussein at the time and did a mutual control of the West Bank and a history. The West Bank, even East Jerusalem, could have been controlled, mutually controlled between the Jordanians and Israelis. In fact, today they're already talking about building a joint Israeli-Jordanian airport in Aqaba. Imagine that. A joint Arab-Israeli, Arab-Jordanian airport. Talking about running railway systems from Jordan to Israel and back. Opening the lines, opening up commerce. I think Jordan genuinely wants to reach out. And I think that's what's going to end up happening. And I think back in the 80s, when the Israelis to return the Sinai finally back the complete completion of their agreement back to Egypt, they had offered Gaza back to Egypt and they didn't want it, even though it was theirs, and the Israelis took it from them in 67. I think Egypt should take responsibility in taking back Gaza and assimilating the Palestinians there, and they can keep their identity of being a Palestinian, just like there are like Southerners of America in the U.S., and there's Mexicans living in America, and Jews living in America, and Italians living in America, and there's Palestinians living in Egypt. And that's their identity. They speak Mitzri, which is Arabic, and a Egyptian form of Arabic anyway, and that would be done. There would be peace. And I believe that will happen. And you watch what I say now and see what happens in the future. And like I said, because peace is the ultimate game, not to incite hate. We need to remove and eradicate ignorance and instead place with tolerance, both in Israel and the Arab nations. We need to change. We need to go into toward walking toward the light. As both belong to the house of Allah, the house of Abraham. So we need to functionally push ourselves in understanding what that conflict. And just like now the conflict within Iraq. And by the way, just to bring a quick comment about the United Nations, which I would call the United Nations of pimps, liars, and hypocrites, because they have not established themselves as a real functioning body of true peace and walking toward light since the late 60s. Since the 70s, they've actually became just a big bull BS game. The only thing established within the UN is basically helping to feed with UNIFIL, you know, hungry people, which is another sort of a joke because that's a whole other subject because with all the obesity around the world and all the people who are starving, it's not there. It isn't food. It's just a political game for distribution of food and needs of people. That's a whole other game. It's the same liking what's happening in the Middle East, calling Zionism racism. Come on. So you're saying every Jew is a racist? And every Mexican is a racist because in Mexico, you have to be Mexican to own land in Mexico. In Japan, you have to be Japanese to own land in Japan. That's racist. That's just being nationalistic. It's just making sure they own their own and keeping their own sovereignty, protecting their own sovereignty. And it's their view. But to start a game of lies and hate, that is wrong. And the Noam Chomsky's should know that. I heard and this is from a long time ago, and even on the YouTube, watching a debate between Dershowitz and Chomsky, and he said, let's move and figure a plan to get both the Palestinians and the Israelis to start a new peace situation, starting to enter peace, stop the terrorism, drop down the walls, bring down the checkpoints. No more violence. Meet at the tables. Draw up the maps. Make the compromise. Mutually accepted. Israel and Palestine live side by side. Peace. Period. But instead, Noam Chomsky comes on about the rhetoric of hate. Oh, they did this and they do this and they do this. And when they sign this agreement, from the very get-go, because they want to go back to playing the game. And I always wonder, maybe it's just to keep their own jobs or they can be on TV and talk their old BS. Like I said, who would benefit? It's like they always say when there's peace, the soldiers and the warriors will know what to do. They have nobody to hate. The haters have nobody to hate if there's peace. And the same token, the people can't build the guns so they can shoot each other. Who makes money off of that? The profit of war and the profit of hate. And then playing the game that, like I said, hating the Jews so that you don't deal with your own real problems, because if there was peace in Israel with the Palestinians, guess what? Oh my God. All the Arab countries are going to have to deal with their own societal problems with themselves and quit playing the Jew. Don't be a Hitler and say, Well, there was a depression because of the Jew, and throughout Prodigal Zion, yeah, there's a massive conspiracy with Jews in the media. Yeah, well, they all get together. And by the way, I got to get my vote in. We have a mass committee. Come on. Enough of the BS and the hate. Deal with your problems. Take care of your people.
We love you, my friend. I agree. Hey, we are a bit over. We are about 5 minutes over, but there's no one after you. So since there's no one after you, I'll take your time in closing.
Okay, I appreciate it. Hey, so, and like I would like to surmise and bring to a close, I like to say to my brethren, whether it's Muslim, Christian, or non-anything, everybody has their own path. I believe, I hope there's peace in the future, that we can turn our weapons into plowshares, and we can eradicate the ignorance and replace it with tolerance and love and mutual respect. Because I say to everybody, Allah is great. Praise be Allah, and praise be God, and praise be Elohim. And may everyone walk into the light. And with that, please check out my book, When the Angels Have Risen. It talks about some of the elements in there. I know you will definitely enjoy reading it. It has an alien connection to it, which I will get into another time. Thought a predicament on this planet, our prison planet. And you can always check out my website at www.andrewfetter.com. And I want to thank everybody for who is listening. And in the future, thank you, and God bless.